and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. President Joe Biden used the D-Day commemorations to call for war rather than peace. And the European elections, are they less than useless? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And of course, in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. Joe Biden is really the most unremarkable president probably ever in American history. But he deviates from his unremarkableness by being remarkably divisive. And at the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landing on June 6th of this year, he gave an appalling speech. Let me just read just a little bit of what he said. They've suffered tremendous losses, Russia. The numbers are staggering. 350,000 Russian troops dead or wounded. Nearly 1 million people have left Russia because they are no longer see a future in Russia. He went on and on. I thought this was to commemorate the death of those that landed in Normandy, and it was the triumph of the West, the Soviet Union, and what was called the Allies, the triumph over Nazism. He didn't make any references to such things, George.
That's exactly right, because we've already become accustomed to the Western habit of ignoring the Soviet contribution to the victory in World War II. I mean, that's now a given every time they have these commemorations. But Biden went a little bit beyond that. Of course, he made no mention of anything that went on in the Eastern Front. Needless to say, he made no mention of Operation Bagration, launched at the same time to relieve the pressure from the Western allies. But he went beyond that. He used this occasion, just as you say, to celebrate the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Russians, but so he claimed, and to mobilize the West against Russia. And so for what he was saying is that those young American men, those Rangers who landed here 80 years ago, they would want to go on to fight against Russia today. You know, this is it's extraordinary sort of, first of all, arrogance on his part to speak on their behalf. But it's also a disgraceful besmirching of this occasion, because he used it to call for war. It's supposed to be the celebration of the end of war, that this brought the war to an end. And, well, the media talked about, oh, he invoked the spirit of Ronald Reagan in 1984. If you look at Reagan's speech in 1984, he talked about ending war. He used that occasion to talk about how great it is to end war and that we should never fight wars again. Biden did something very different. As you say, he's very divisive. And to use this occasion to call for war is really nothing short of just absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, and Martin, it is Biden's war. This is an elite war. This is something that is being pursued against the wishes of the populations of what they call now Western Europe and the West, the United States, Canada, and so forth here. If this would have been a remarkable opportunity to talk about, instead of calling for greater depth of war, how about talking about security? I looked at his speech very carefully. There's nothing in reference to security. And this is what this conflict is all about. It's not about Ukraine. It's about pan-European security, which Biden and his circle and, you know, the Europeans as well refuse to face up to. Martin.
Yeah, it's disgusting, as George says, but I think it's also a new level of desperation from Biden. He's not really somebody who's interested in peace. He's a warmonger. It's been very clear. He's really shown us that in his term in office. And the depth of depravity, I think, is just staggering. You know, we're looking at an administration now that's going to be remembered for decades to come for the thousands of children killed in Gaza, you know, for the disingenuous, if not disgusting, two-faced narrative that was coming from Biden about the Israelis, about wanting them to stop the war. And yet, you know, just this week, we've seen that the floating PIA is actually not about helping poor Gazans at all. It's about military operations. And, you know, I think when for him to take this opportunity at D-Day to not reflect on the greatness of the event and to be respectful to those who died on those shores, but to actually turn it into a PR event, I don't think that's going to do him any favours. You know, I think, look, the event itself is not going to be remembered for that. Let's face it. You know, we are all driven now by a very, very short attention span, and social media is really the thing that's the important thing now. We will remember in years to come him trying to sit down on an imaginary chair, or was he passing wind, or even defecating? I don't know. You know, he was quickly escorted away by Jill. Looked like a nappy change to me. He'll be remembered for that. He'll be I think the iconic video clip we'll remember perhaps in years to come is the four of them standing there, Joe Biden turning around really slowly and looking in the opposite direction, and the three others slowly following him, Jill being the last one. You know, the Macrons kind of slowly turned around in this really, really banal Monty Python sketch to look the other way.
This is what people bring up. A good point, Martin. I mean, George, I mean, you know, that this was the liberation of Europe, okay? I mean, this is a European commemorative event. And where are the Europeans? I mean, we've seen over the last few months those wanting to get as close to Biden in his position as possible to be even more aggressive than the Biden administration. And the Biden administration is pretty aggressive right now. I mean, it's this was supposed to be about the fate of Europe, but they seem to abdicate their responsibility for Europe. I mean, what good has Europe experienced with this conflict? Go ahead, George.
None whatsoever. I mean, when you look at in terms of security, in terms of economic well-being, in every way, Europe has done disastrously out of the war. And, you know, we've got, unfortunately, you know, a number of states that have been inducted into these European structures, the EU and NATO, whose one goal seems to be to stir conflict with Russia. Quite why that is, it is a mystery, but all the Baltic states and Poland, and that includes also, you know, some of the states like such as Romania, they just want to stir up conflict with Russia. And then we have the United Kingdom, which again just seems to have completely gone off the deep end and wants a war with Russia. And again, the whole point of having these sorts of occasions is to celebrate the end of a war. That's to say, that's it, we did this, you know, it's now many years behind us, and we're not going to do this again. It's not supposed to be, let's mobilize for another war. And so at this very moment, here, you know, Biden, who is now apparently given the go-ahead to use American weapons on Russian territory to kill Russians. And what's the response from Europeans? And I'm not even just talking about Zelensky. Oh, this is too little too late. You've got to, you know, allow these weapons to be used deeper into Russian territory and provide a lot more so that we can kill a lot more Russians. What on earth has that got to do with any kind of a commemoration of the end of a war? Well, of course, it hasn't. And so that's we're here now mobilizing for war. It's now given that somehow we're now getting ready for war.
Yeah, but Martin, but simultaneously, as those events were unfolding, we had Biden also speak to the French Assembly. Simultaneously, there was a forum going on in St. Petersburg where Vladimir Putin was questioned for hours on end, as he usually gives the opportunity to in domestic and foreign media. The number of feelers that have gone out over the last few weeks, I mean, this is willfully ignoring what's going on. To both of you, this event in Normandy could have been a very interesting opportunity to address those feelers, okay? As the end of fascism in Europe is commemorated, how can we make the European continent safe again? It would have been an opportunity. They missed it intentionally. Martin.
They did miss it intentionally. And unfortunately, when you use that word fascism, there's a certain irony to that.
We'll talk about fascism. That in the second half of the program. Keep going. Yeah.
All right, yeah, but I mean, you know, it's at the same time, Scott Ritter wasn't allowed to get on a plane and go to that forum, and it was, you know, these are the kind of things that we've been harping on about for decades about countries from the East, you know, who not having such democratic values as us. But now we're doing the same. You know, now we've become those countries, and I think that the Scott Ritter incident was quite a stark reminder that we're going backwards, we're losing our democratic freedoms, we're becoming much more autocratic. And the whole thing about DDA and, you know, Biden and all these world leaders standing around and banging on the drum about war is that there is now a conspiracy amongst all these Western elites to crank up defense spending, to create a sense of panic, a sense of fear, so that people perhaps are comfortably taken by the hand to a place where they don't normally want to go and shown stories by the media that they wouldn't normally look at, disregarding some of the bigger stories of, you know, governance, poor governance, that, you know, gets swept under the carpet. This is what it's really all about. It's about fear-mongering. And I think it was a real, real shame what Biden did, you know, and he talked about in Ukraine. And then, you know, there was a lot, for me, it was very disrespectful and everything, even Zelensky turning up in his usual kind of cult, kind of glad rag nonsense, you know, sort of commando BS, whatever he is.
Considering the political forces that have surrounded him, the political coloration, if you get my drift, okay, and having someone like that.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about respecting all those people who died. You could have at least put on a show.
It was a crusade against fascism. Communist Soviet Union and the liberal West joined forces to destroy fascism, okay? Any woof of fascism on that stage is soiling history, if George knows what I mean here. George, right before we go to the break here, maybe this will be the year that people, the historical memory will be that the Soviet Union was the enemy of the West in the Second World War. Do you think that's possible?
Absolutely, it's possible. Yep. If you look at Biden's speech, he's pretty much saying that the war against Hitler goes on, and it's a, you know, and it's the same war as the one against Putin and Russia. He's very much made the case that it's the same war, and I mean, and we've talked about this before, that there's a very rapid revision of history in which somehow that the mobilization of the European continent that Hitler had attempted against the Soviet Union is actually a worthwhile project, and it's just that, you know, there were aspects of Hitler that was unacceptable.
The French press reporting it was a first step. Normandy was a first step. Very interesting. Not mentioning the Soviet experience at all. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle here. We're discussing some real news. Martin, let me go to you in Marrakesh again. We have, as we're speaking right now, the polls are closing across Europe with the European parliamentary election. There's a lot of parties, a lot of alliances, you know, and the number crunchers are out there. I think I actually took some notes here. 450 million people are eligible to vote. Probably less than half will. Who goes to these elections? Okay, because I bet you, George, I bet you, you know, if you went and walked around Budapest after this and say, who represents us in the European Parliament? I bet you nobody knows, zero. Martin, who votes in these elections?
The people who vote in these elections traditionally have always been people who are passionate about the European Union ideology, the project. And the EU elite knows this. The EU elite doesn't want fair elections. If it wanted fair elections, it would do what Australia or Belgium does, which is force people to vote legally. So if you didn't vote, you'd get fined. The EU would never do that, because if you force people to vote, you would find a very, very low turnout for the conventional big power blocks in the European Parliament, which is the Christian Democrats and the Socialists. You know, those are really the two big groups that control everything in the European Parliament. So what happens is you get a high turnout for people who are passionate about the EU, who vote for one of those two blocks, and you get a low turnout for all the other independents or the liberals.
Is this like American primaries? It's only the true believers that go out and vote?
It's only the true believers, but it is changing. This is the important point. It is changing. In the last couple of European elections, what you're finding now is that people are using the EU elections as a protest vote to their own political situation in their own countries. And that protest vote is always far right. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean people believe in the far right at all. You know, for them, the MEP vote is a throwaway vote anyway. They don't believe in the project. They think that, you know, there's an enormous amount of corruption from this autocratic organization, which is anti-democratic anyway. But so it's a throwaway vote. It's a protest vote. You just tick the far right group. I think we're going to see in the next couple of days, I think this is going to be unprecedented this time around. I think it's going to be a very high number of people who are protesting against...
Well, Martin, you bring up an interesting point, and this is something, when I look at the European Parliament, and actually, it's also to some degree, Georgie, if you look at German elections, you know, where you have people voting, however it's defined, far right or right, it's a protest vote. I mean, but at what point is there a tipping point where it's more than a protest vote? Because we can turn this all upside down. You know, it's a throwaway vote. It doesn't really matter. But for a lot more and more people, this is the only way that they can actually express their opinion. Sure. It can cut both ways. We'll see what the results are. George.
Well, I think that's right. And I think Martin makes a very good point that the people who actually show up to vote are the ones who are EU enthusiasts. And so it's a kind of a lopsided vote that, we often expect, well, in this election, the far right will do well. They may do well. I mean, it's a possibility. But I suspect that they won't do as well as we expect. Simply because I think their voters are just not going to show up. And ultimately, it's because the European Parliament is really a fraud. I mean, it's not really a parliament in any meaningful sense. I mean, the
whole purpose of a
parliament is to legislate. I mean, that's what parliament's supposed to do. But the EU Parliament really doesn't legislate. The European Commission and the European Council.
Yeah, but aren't those members of Parliament really well compensated, George? Also,
they are extremely well compensated, which itself is a scandal, and which is that here is this institution that really has no power other than essentially to act as a rubber stamp for the decisions made by the European Commission and the European Council. So, but the MEPs are extremely well compensated, and it all costs a lot of money, you know, having all that building and then, you know, having these people. They also don't do a lot of work. I think they only show up, I think, two, three days a week. So,
let me throw this to Martin. I mean, they like to have these great expressions of outrage, you know, we're going to equate this with this, and, you know, they make these big historical pronouncements and all that, you know, and then I'm sure they go to the wet bar afterwards and celebrate, but nobody really cares what they do.
No, but George struck on a very good point. It is a rubber stamping organization. I mean, what you've got to remember is when the architects of the European Union, you know, Schuman and Spinelli set up the whole project, they forgot to make it democratic. The idea of the European Parliament was a bolt-on last-minute idea because they thought, my God, we've got to have at least the pretense of some sort of democracy here. So let's create a parliament, you know. And really, that's really what the MEPs do. The big part of their job is just simply to rubber stamp. Tweak a little bit, but ultimately rubber stamp a massive amount of draft legislation which is pumped into it every single day from the European Commission. Now, if the European Commission didn't do that, if it somehow streamlined the number of draft legislation that it created, of course, the Parliament would be useless. You'd have nothing to do. So they're both feeding off one another. The raison d'etre of the MEPs is very much down to how much draft legislation is pumped through the machinery. But, you know, in terms of power, George is absolutely correct. It's the only Parliament I know in the whole world that doesn't have the MPs don't have the right to draft any legislation themselves. You know, they can only talk about it or create little papers themselves.
Well, I'll be honest with both of you in our audience here. Throw it to George now. There's those two Irish people. That's the only thing I know about the and they come out with really very passionate speeches, which I almost always completely agree with. Okay, that's the only thing that enters my world from this huge body that's so wasteful, you know, big elections, you know, they pump all the money into it. For the most part, it is trying to always be a referendum that the EU is doing a good thing. That's all it's doing. Okay. And, you know, and on top of that, George, you and I have talked about this, and it's always the right wing pouncing and, you know, the radicals. Okay. How much truth is that to that, George?
Well, you're absolutely right. And but what always strikes me is when I see those two, Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, is that, well, why is it only just them? I mean, is there anyone else? I mean, there are somehow, I think there's 720 MEPs, but it's always those two who are talking any sense at all.
And, well, Nigel Farage did for a while.
Nigel Farage, that's right. But the remark, well, what do the others do? What exactly is their role? And but apparently, you know, the big issue now is, well, are they going to give Ursula von der Leyen a second term? You know, nobody really knows. There's some all sorts of horse trading. Will Giorgia Meloni support von der Leyen? You know, they have these very good relationships.
Is it because she's done such a good job?
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's really the issue. What is it that von der Leyen, I mean, she's in the middle of her own scandal about why did they order, something like 4.5 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine, you know, given the population I think 4.5 billion. Four and a half billion. Sorry. So in other words, because the population of the EU is, I think, 450 million. So that comes to 10 doses per citizen of the EU. So the question, well, why did she order 10 doses? And then she expects the Europeans to pay for it. But she's not revealing any of her messages that she exchanged with Pfizer. So she has been an absolute disaster. But because of the machinations of the bureaucracy, she may well get herself another term. She's very vigorously campaigning for a second term.
I saw a little blurb before we convene here, Martin. She says these elections are important because it's to protect Europe's democracy. Is that what's front and center here?
No, it's to protect the super elites and their jobs, you know, the establishment that we don't necessarily see every day on our television screens. She's sort of the front end of that, you know. But you're talking about that little publicity video that she made where she's walking through the country, jogging through the countryside, you know, and she comes to this charming, German house. And unfortunately, we didn't cut to, you know, gilt-edged photographs of her forefathers in Waffen-SS uniforms on top of the piano. I wish we would have done that. It would have been much more interesting. But she's done a good job in keeping the status quo, in keeping the elite where they are. And Biden likes her. And, you know, probably she needs to stay another 5 years to really immune herself from any outside prosecution over the Pfizer scandal from companies or member states. You know, a couple of months ago, it was announced that the EU's own internal fraud department are investigating her. You know, wow, we really should expect something from that, right? You know, her own friends in the European Commission actually investigating or whitewashing, we'll see. But I think, we're probably looking at 5 more years from her as well, which is quite
depressing. I don't know what's going on here, gentlemen, considering what we talked about in the first half of the program and now what we're talking about now. George, did Germany win the Second World War? I mean, that's what it's beginning to look like.
it sure looks like it. Germany's there, always in attendance at all these ceremonies. Russia was not invited at the ceremonies. And of course, you know, who's leading the charge in Europe? It's Germany, which is openly talking about. We've had Annalena Baerbock saying, "We are at war with Russia." Then she said, no, that's fake news. I didn't say it. You know, there it is. She said it. Germany has dropped all pretense.
That's right.
It went through in the 1970s, 1980s, that somehow it's that this is a new country. We're very, very different from what we used to be. We don't have any hatred for anyone. You know, we're you know, full of milk of human kindness towards everyone. Henceforth, only peace will emanate from German soil. That was its commitment in 1990. Germany has step by step abandoned all of that. It's all the Russophobia that was so prevalent in Germany in the 1930s and before World War One. It's once again it dominates the political scene. The way Ursula von der Leyen talks about Russia, the way Annalena Baerbock talks about Russia, and you get in the German media.
Well, do you think both women are channeling their ancestors' views, George?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the Germans now feel unrestrained. They don't have to pretend in the way they had to for some years that this is they're a new people. They don't have any of that horrible, horrible, nasty aspects of Germany. I think this is very much the Germany that we've been familiar with in the past.
Yeah, and we have the defense minister talking about rearmament being necessary to fight a war by 2029. Against whom? It's left unsaid. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. It goes so quickly. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.